Well, thanks for joining me for this podcast on Matthew 15, 21 into 16, verse 12. Let's dive right in. As always, I'll be reading in the Phillips translation. Jesus then left that place and retired into the Tyre and Sidon district. There, a Canaanite woman from those parts came to him, crying at the top of her voice, "Lord, have pity on me. My daughter is in a terrible state. A devil has got into her." Okay, so we've got a lot to talk about here. Jesus then left that place being Gennesaret, a town on the northwest coast of the Sea of Galilee, a place he'd arrived to after, walking on water, where he'd healed the whole countryside's population of the sick, and then it had a pretty tremendous confrontation with the scribes and Pharisees. And he retired into the Tyre and Sidon district, which was actually quite a journey, essentially out of Israel, up to the Mediterranean Sea coast, something like 40 or 50 miles, depending on his exact destination there. There, a Canaanite woman from those parts, meaning she belonged there, this was her land, came to him, crying at the top of her voice, "Lord, have pity on me." Can you imagine how the first burst of her cry must have startled Jesus' entourage after this long, silent journey out of the Galilee? I mean, even here, he is known and immediately needed. And why does she come? "My daughter is in a terrible state. A devil has got into her." This woman wants to set up a battle now between the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of the evil one. Wow, this is really quite an opening. And why, you might ask, do I give this little preamble to kind of bring you into the scene? Well, because this scene, up in the Syrophoenician district with this woman, is probably the most awkward moment we ever experience reading of Jesus. And so I wanted you to begin to see it as he saw it. Let's keep reading. Jesus made no answer. No answer. In the face of the tears and cries of this woman, no answer, nothing, silence. It makes not only us, but his disciples uncomfortable too. And the disciples came up to him and said, "Do send her away. She's still following us and calling out." Which, by the way, is the precise moment right there where this narrative actually splits, in my opinion, into two tracks. The natural and the supernatural, or you might call them the human and the heavenly. You see, for the disciples, Jesus' silence registers as disinterest or disinclination to engage with this woman. So, hearing nothing from him, in their human understanding, they want this thing just over with. They want her gone. They've heard enough. But listen to him. "I was only sent," replied Jesus, "to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." He's thinking of something else entirely, of his mission and its stated objective, both of which were handed to him in the throne room of heaven by his heavenly Father. That's what Jesus is currently thinking about. And here's what I really love about this moment. The woman, the Canaanite mother, somehow seems to perceive this alternate economy Jesus is operating in, and by faith, she engages him there. Because watch, imagine. "Then the woman came and knelt at his feet. 'Lord, help me,' she said." It's like she's peering through the veil, through the not yet torn curtain. It's like her belief has given her eyes to see what's possible here. This is a woman who has ascertained the power and the character of Jesus to a degree that almost no one else has yet. Which, in my opinion, is the reason that Jesus now tests the character and power of the belief that he perceives in her. These next words, though strange sounding to us coming off the written page, are a tremendous test by Jesus of what's possible in this woman's heart. Listen. "It is not right, you know," Jesus replied, to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. Yes, Lord, I know. But even the dogs live on the scraps that fall from their master's table. You certainly don't lack faith, returned Jesus. It shall be as you wish. And at that moment, her daughter was cured. Like, wherever she was, suddenly, well, the power of Jesus, operating through the pipeline, the channel of human belief, is able to heal anywhere at any time. This mother turns on her heel, having looked God in the eye and having believed, and returns home with both that experience and the fruit of his goodness. And at that moment, her daughter was cured. And at that moment, something else was happening too. Here's how Paul describes it later on in Romans 9. I want you to listen to this. Can we not see in this his purpose in demonstrating the boundless resources of his glory upon those whom he considers fit to receive his mercy and whom he long ago planned to raise to glorious life? And by these chosen people, I mean you and me, whom he has called out from both Jews and Gentiles. He says in Hosea, I will call that my people, which was not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. And it shall be that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there shall they be called sons of the living God. Yes! You see, with this woman, with that courageously believing centurion back in Matthew 8, if you remember, Jesus is tearing down the wall between Jew and Gentile, between races, between any ideology of separation, man from man or man from God. It's had me thinking this week of one of my favorite sections in all of Leo Tolstoy's writings, when he talks of the kingdom of heaven progression out of the animal individual life, on past the social tribal view of life, all the way to the goal of all this, the divine universal that is wrapped up in the person and personality of Jesus. He, Jesus, is the union point of all human history. And he's asking you to believe. It's a pretty good opening section, isn't it? All right, let's keep going. Jesus left there, walking along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, then climbed the hill and sat down. And again, the Tyre and Sidon district was 40 or 50 miles away, so his return to the Galilee was probably at least a week after his departure. A week since he'd walked this pebbly shoreline, seen the sparkle of the sunlight on these waters, walked up amidst the tall grass to his favorite spot on his favorite hill. A lot can happen in a week of human life when you're out of the picture, can't it? Well, I sure hope that the people of the Galilee will remember him, given his absence. And great crowds came to him. I would add, like, yep, just like that. Bringing with them people who were lame, crippled, blind, mute, and many others. They simply put them down at his feet, and he healed them. The result was that the people were astonished at seeing mute men speak, crippled men healed, lame men walking about, and blind men having recovered their sight. And they praised the God of Israel. May I borrow your imagination for a moment? Imagine you were alive then. Imagine you were in the Galilee. Imagine you were, say, on a hike in these same hills, under the same blue sky, feeling the same breeze on your face on this same day. Looking up, you happen to notice the strangest sight. It's hundreds of people, actually no, thousands, trekking from all the nearby towns toward what appears to be the same spot. On top of the numbers, you also can't help noticing that a huge majority of these people have maladies, illnesses, and disabilities. It catches your attention. So you follow them. And yes, sure enough, they are all going to the same place. Actually, better put, to the same man. And this is when things begin to get a little bit crazy for you. You begin to actually watch What's happening? They move to the front, or for some of them, get carried to the front. The man smiles upon them, talks to them for a moment, and then you see this for yourself. He touches them, they rise, they are well. They then move to the back to let hundreds of others go to where they just were. One after another, all healed. What would you think I mean if I said that Christianity should be nothing more and nothing less than those verses, Matthew 15:29 to 31? Might I mean that it's only Jesus, alive and ever on the move, and that proximity to him is everything? Or that it is properly peopled by broken people, needy people, sinful people who actually expect to be forever set free? Might I mean that Christianity without expectancy, without verifiable human results, is actually foolishness? Might I? And that the goal of all this is wholehearted praise and robust, direct interconnectedness with the Godhead? I don't know. Do you think that's what I mean? We continue. But Jesus quietly called his disciples to him. "My heart goes out to this crowd," he said. "They've stayed with me 3 days now and have no more food. I don't want to send them home without anything, or they will collapse on the way." And just in the way that he tested the resolve of that Canaanite woman's belief, now Jesus is testing the belief, resolve, and, don't miss this, the remembrance of his disciples. Because just so you know, it has probably been less than 2 weeks since he fed a crowd of many thousands with 5 loaves and 2 fish. So now, reimagine the look on his face as he draws the disciples close, and I want you to listen again to perhaps how he spoke the words of verse 32. "My heart goes out to this crowd. They've stayed with me 3 days now and have no more food. I don't want to send them home without anything, or they will collapse on the way." His disciples listen to this. "Where could we find enough food to feed such a crowd in this deserted spot?" said the disciples. "Oh boy." "Well, how many loaves have you?" asked Jesus, looking, we can imagine, piercingly into their eyes. "7, and a few small fish," they replied, with, it would appear, not an ounce of deja vu. Then Jesus told the crowds to sit down comfortably on the ground. And when he had taken the 7 loaves and the fish into his hands, he broke them with a prayer of thanksgiving and gave them to the disciples to pass on to the people. I mean, does muscle memory kick in here? Do they at all begin to remember, like, hey, wait a minute, weren't we just doing this a couple weeks ago? Well, perhaps the result will remind them, I hope. Everybody ate and was satisfied. Satisfied, sated, full. The Lord Jesus, in the presence of enormous crowds of people, is totally uninhibited by the absence of a plan or normal resources. And I would add, again, he's done this before. Or actually, let me put it another way. This man, Jesus, has no need or use for plans or resources. He himself alone has all that is needed to satisfy the hearts of all mankind. A question for, say, the modern church, for present-day Christianity, is, do we find the hearts of mankind satisfied, full of Jesus? Or are we perhaps in his way with our resources and plans? Or I'll take it to a more granular level. Are you satisfied? Have you found all life in this Jesus? Because if not, I guarantee it's true for me, the stumbling block lies generally in our plans, our resources, and certainly not him. Because this is who he is, and he is unchanging from that day to this day. And the disciples picked up 7 baskets full of the pieces left over. And maybe right then, finally, they were thinking to themselves, hey, wait a minute. Those who ate numbered 4,000 men, apart from women and children. Then Jesus sent the crowds home, boarded the boat, and arrived at the district of Magadan. Now, once we bridge into chapter 16, the Pharisees and the Sadducees arrive together to test him. And I would say it from last week again, here comes the good times, gang. And they asked him to give them a sign from heaven. Something like, you know, feeding an enormous crowd, or healing scores of people, or walking on water. You choose, Jesus. What can you do? But he replied, when the evening comes, you say, ah, fine weather, the sky is red. In the morning, you say, there will be a storm today, the sky is red and threatening. Yes, you know how to interpret the look of the sky, but you have no idea how to interpret the signs of the times. A wicked and unfaithful age insists on a sign, and it will not be given any sign at all but that of the prophet Jonah. And he turned on his heel and left them. And by the way, think about it this way for a minute. The fury that this almost absolutely causes those scribes, Pharisees, and Sadducees, because it's yet another failed confrontation with Jesus, that fury is just one more reason that they build toward a prosecution that then yields an execution, that then nets a resurrection from the dead, the presently described sign of Jonah. Isn't it fascinating that this interaction and what is to come is all of a piece? Jesus knows that too, by the way. Just the same way that he already knows your life. Isn't that fascinating? We keep going. Then his disciples came to him on the other side of the lake, forgetting to bring any bread with them. Oh no, I don't think this is going to go well. Keep your eyes open, said Jesus to them, and be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. But they were arguing with each other and saying, we forgot to bring bread. Yeah, I'm sure that's what this is about. When Jesus saw this, he said to them, why all this argument among yourselves about not bringing any bread, you little faiths? Don't you understand yet? Or have you forgotten the 5 loaves and the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up afterwards? Or the 7 loaves and the 4,000 and how many baskets you took up then? And they're like, yeah. He goes on, I wonder why you don't yet understand that I wasn't talking about bread at all. I told you to beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Then they grasped the fact that he had not told them to beware of yeast in the ordinary sense, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees. My friend, sitting wherever you're sitting right now, I would love to know, I wish we could talk. What do you think the yeast of the Sadducees and Pharisees is? What is their base teaching? What do you think? Well, to me, it's a system of what I might call the historical aggregation of traditions and traditionalizing that, as we talked about in the last podcast, is really all sourced from a heart far from God. It is externalism disguised as faithfulness. It is the final and ugliest form of religion. But what in Jesus would be the precise opposite? Like, what are we after? Well, listen. I believe that we are after a way of contemporary, present experience of his spirit and presence that, as we also talked about last week, is all sourced from his literally living inside our hearts. It is internalism, his internalism, as the only way to perfect faithfulness. Doesn't that sound wonderfully refreshing and alive? Well, it's what Jesus is offering to you today. Thanks for listening.